St. John, veteran war correspondent and best-selling author, today defends his new book, Shalom Means Peace, on The Author Meets the Critics, in a literary free-for-all, no-holds-barred. But first, meet the man who keeps the peace on these programs, John K.M. McCaffrey.
Good afternoon, everyone. Robert St. John is probably the only man in the world with a bullet scar in one leg from Al Capone and in the other leg from Adolf Hitler. During the war, he visited 29 countries. In the London Blitz, he was radio commentator for NBC. In the battle for Greece, he was wounded, helping the evacuation. His first book, called From the Land of the Silent People, the story of the Nazi attack on Yugoslavia and its struggles under Nazi occupation, was read all over America. Since the war, Mr. St. John has gone on traveling and observing. In his new book, Shalom Means Peace, he tells of the birth of a new nation, Israel, and of its desperate struggle for peace. And now, with a brief account of this dramatic story, here is Mr. St. John himself.
Good afternoon, Mr. McCaffrey. Good afternoon, Mr. McCaffrey, critics and friends. In the preface to Shalom Means Peace, I wrote, "The words which follow are not an attempt to pass judgment on the rights and wrongs which have been committed in Palestine. This is not the report of an expert on Arab Zionist affairs. This is merely the story of a few people I met who played their large and small roles in making a dream come true. A few people who found their promised land. I want to admit at the start that I went to the Middle East with a certain bias. Not a bias against Arabs, because I believe a great many Arabs have been victims of what has happened in the Middle East. The bias I took with me was a sympathy for, well, Joe Murphy, an Irish-American flyer whose story I've told in the book, put it as well as I can put it when he tried to explain why he had turned down an offer of $3,000 a month to fly against the Jews and was risking his life helping to defend the state of Israel. He said, I guess I just don't like to see little people pushed around. That's my bias. Through stories about settlers in the kibbutzim, factory owners and factory workers, Arabs and Jews, musicians and college professors who are now farmers, I've tried to give some pictures of this newest democracy on earth in human terms. I wish, it probably won't happen here, but I wish these critics and other critics elsewhere would judge Shalom Means Peace on that basis. Have I succeeded in putting on paper the hopes and fears and dreams of these people? Have I made it possible for an Iowa farmer and a New York City telephone operator to understand their opposite numbers in the state of Israel? To understand that there is not much difference in their hopes and dreams, that shalom is what we all want, a chance to go to work secure from fear, a chance to come home and watch the children at play, a chance to live at peace. It seems such a little thing to ask.
Thank you, Mr. St. John. And now, before Mr. St. John meets his critics face to face, let's have a sample of their points of view. First, Nobel Prize winner and author of the recent widely read book, The Steep Places, Sir Norman Angell.
In order to save confusion, I want to say this. That for 30 years, I have been an ardent and hard-working Zionist. In Parliament, in the press, on the platform, in books. Furthermore, from the beginning of the Hitlerite persecutions, I carried on, day in, day out, an agitation for lifting the barriers to refugee immigration into Britain. I wrote a book on that subject, which had a wide circulation. In that book was included a defense of Zionism and an indictment of anti-Semitism as severe as I could make it. If I have any criticism of Mr. St. John's book, it isn't therefore that I would say broadly that it favors Zionism. Not for that, but that it seems to me necessary to utter a few warnings about its implications, because the effect of those implications is still further to obscure truths already too much forgotten. It will strengthen fallacies, the perpetuation of which will do ill service in the long run alike to Zion, to world Jewry, to the security of the United States, and to that peace of the world, that shalom, which I'm quite sure the author desires to see promoted.
Thank you, Sir Norman. And now, with a distinctly different attitude, the well-known journalist who has written a book of her own about Israel called Destination Palestine, Miss Ruth Gruber.
Shalom means peace, is a personal, subjective, intimate story of a nation being born. It makes no effort to be profound or thoroughgoing. It's the frank report of a journalist who went to Israel to see how Jews, once men of the pen and the purse, today became men of the plow and the gun. It is a readable, articulate account of how Britain threw in her lot with the Arabs and was defeated completely. Yet it is by no means an anti-British book. It attempts to show the genuine sadness with which many of the Jews in Israel watched the twilight of British rule. St. John not only gathered a staggering quantity of facts which many readers in America have been asking about Israel, but he also colored almost anyone who would talk to him on the beach or his hotel lobby or in the movies. Reading the book for anyone who has been to Israel in the last few months is like old home week in Tel Aviv. St. John did everything a tourist or a journalist on a quick trip would do. He went to the collective farms and saw the miracle on the desert. He went to the movies with pretty girls and saw American movies spoken in English with French titles on the bottom, Hebrew running up and down the right side, and Arabic running up and down the left side. He talked to DPs who had survived Hitler's Germany and Bevan's Cyprus, only to be killed by Egyptian planes with British pilots. He recognized that one of the reasons the Jews won the war was because they had a secret weapon, a weapon which in Hebrew was called Ein Brera, which means no alternative. The Egyptians could go home to Egypt. The Syrians could go home to Syria. The Transjordanians could go home to Transjordan. But for the Jews, every bridge behind them was burned. They would either stand and survive in Israel, or they would collapse and be totally wiped out.
Thank you, Miss Gruber. If you knew Bob St. John as well as I do, you wouldn't have been surprised that he was going to the movies with pretty girls. But, Sir Norman, I wonder if we could have you expand on your statement that this book has fallacies in it, gives credence to fallacies which would do the cause of Zionism and of world peace harm.
Not so much fallacies, perhaps, as omissions, which ought not to be made when we're discussing the future security of Israel itself. It doesn't really tackle at all, perhaps it doesn't profess to, the position of Israel as a world problem. Its part, that is, in the East-West struggle, which is going on for a long time. Particularly does it not grapple with the problem of Israel's relation to 40 million Arabs, whose nationalism, too, is very intense, who believe themselves to be right, although, as I've written so often, I believe them often wrong. Its relation to 300 millions of the Muslim world, to the future of Africa. Miss Gruber made a reference a moment ago to Britain throwing in her lot with the Arabs. I think she's rather forgotten that for several years, just before the war, Britain was grappling with an Arab rebellion in Palestine. And I think it's one of the fallacies to which I refer that we think of Britain as pro-Arab, when in fact the Arab hatred of Britain is intense as that of the Jews.
Miss Gruber.
I think what Sir Norman perhaps means to say is not that these are fallacies in St. John's book, because he says that St. John has merely failed to mention them. I don't find that
the
thing.
Well, the phrase threw in their lot with the Arabs was yours, as a
matter of fact. Yes, but the beginning of his argument was that he was going to enlarge, you had asked him to enlarge, on his first remarks that there were fallacies in the book.
Yes, I added omissions.
Yes, they were definitely omissions. And I think, since you and I both are authors, that we really ought not ask authors to write the kind of books we want to read. We ought to read the kind of books they want to write and accept the books as they write them, either for what they are or what they aren't. But I think that when you say that Britain... that we shouldn't say that Britain threw in her lot with the Arabs, I think, Sir John, that there's no reason to let patriotism and love for countrymen, a instinct with which I agree deeply, of course, to blind one to the fact that Britain did attempt to create chaos in Palestine, that Britain did open the gates to the Arabs, that Britain was the one who gave them the planes and guns and tanks with which to destroy the Jews. It was your own great leader, Churchill, who just 2 weeks ago denounced Bevan for being anti-Semitic, for having created fiasco and muddle in Palestine, for pursuing a policy of folly, stupidity, and fatuity. I think Bevan was as surprised and hurt when the Jews licked the Arabs as Mr. Gallup and Mr. Roper were when Truman licked Dewey.
It's well to recall the stupidity of Bevin. And I've indulged in that sort of criticism myself. Remembering, however, that criticism just as severe has come from Americans about the State Department conduct of policy in Palestine. And there have been, five secretaries of state in 5 years, I think. But I get back to this position of the Arab and Britain, because it concerns the future. It concerns what we've got to do in order to secure shalom. And if I return to that point, it is because that is the title of Mr. St. John's book. Future peace can only come if we realize the Arab point of view. Part of the Arab point of view is this, and more than one Arab has said it to me. We hate Britain, we shall continue to hate Britain, mainly because only by your effort has the establishment of a Jewish state been possible. If Britain had not introduced the Balfour Declaration, there would have been no Jewish state. Before Britain went into Palestine, an Arab once pointed out to me, for 1,500 years, nearly 2,000 years, there had reached Palestine at most 80,000 Jews. Britain was there for 25 years, and at the end of those 25 years of anti-Semitic Britain, there were 600,000 Jews. And Britain is represented almost everywhere as being the enemy of the Jews, having done more for Israel in 25 years than Israel had managed to do on its own steam in the preceding nearly 2,000.
Miss Gerber?
Sir Norman, I think that the fact that the Arabs hate the British doesn't militate against the British loving the Arabs. They continue to love the Arabs despite everything the Arabs do to them. I think the old British imperialist doctrine of divide and rule has made Britain the most unpopular country in the Middle East. I agree with you completely that the Arabs hate the British, so much so that when I was in Egypt in 1946, having just flown in from Berlin, I wore a U.S. war correspondent's uniform and was asked by an English officer to take my correspondent's uniform off because the Arabs might kill me. And I said, can't they read? Can't they see? It has a big U.S. sign on my sleeve. And he said, no, they can't read, and anybody in uniform to them is an Englishman and therefore to be hated. But that hasn't prevented Mr. Bevan from carrying through a completely pro-Arab policy in the last few years. No one is more cognizant than I of the fact that it was the British who first created the Balfour Declaration. But it was the British who then immediately began to nibble away at the Balfour Declaration and who began first to divide the land they had given to the Jews into Transjordan and Palestine and continued to make it smaller and smaller until they had created a police state inside of Palestine.
Well, I'm afraid now that it's time to hear from our... I'm not afraid. I'm glad that it's time now to hear from our author of the afternoon. I don't think I could restrain him. I haven't been able to restrain him. The floor is yours, Mr. St. John.
John, what do you mean, afraid? You're afraid you won't get the microphone back from me?
Sorry, Bob.
I would like to point out that there is in existence a thing called the set of books called the Jewish Encyclopedia. It runs to 12 volumes and only lightly touches a great number of subjects. I could have written, Ruth Gruber could have written, Sir Norman could have written a 12-volume work and still not been inclusive. Criticism of Sir Norman that there are certain things, certain errors of omission, does not bother me. I did not attempt to write an encyclopedia. Sir Norman says that I did not discuss the future security of Israel or Israel as a world problem. I did not attempt to do that at all. Had I attempted to and failed, that would have been another matter. Sir Norman says I do not grapple with the problem of Israel as it fits into the East and West War. I refer our Sir Norman and our listeners to the daily newspaper or any radio program which will take care of that matter. That is out of my scope. Sir Norman rather belittles what Ruth Gruber called the stupidity of Bevan, and recalls the past glories of Britain in the Middle East. General Allenby, I suppose he's thinking of. The stupidity of Bevan almost cost the lives of 800,000 Jews. Ruth Gruber was in Israel when I was there. It's a little difficult to sit here in New York City and not be emotional when one remembers the British Spitfires that were dropping bombs made in Britain on orphanages in Tel Aviv inhabited by little children who escaped all the horrors that the diseased mind of man in Europe had been able to conjure up to torture the bodies and souls of other human beings, only to be killed in the Promised Land. Sir Norman says that shalom can come only if we understand the Arab point of view. I say to you that shalom can come only if some people begin to understand the Jewish point of view. And the Jewish point of view is simply that they want a little corner of the earth somewhere. We will only let it trickle into our country. There are very few places they can go. We will have shalom only if we understand the Jewish point of view, which is that there are a few hundred thousand tired, unhappy people in still behind the fences of DP camps who want a little corner of the earth that they can call their own, that they can plow with a plow, that they can on which they can plant trees, and where they can have a little shalom. Sir Norman would like to take credit for Britain for the fact that there were, when the British left, 600,000 Jews in Palestine. No, Sir Norman. Britain cannot take credit for that. The boys, many of them Americans, who ran the illegal ships that ran through the blockade of British guns will take credit for that, not Great Britain.
Sir Norman?
Well, I still insist that you cannot ensure the peace of Israel. And we are discussing here shalom and peace if we disregard entirely the point of view of 40 million Arabs. I would like, however, to counter Mr. St. John's view that the existence of Israel today is not due to Great Britain. I suggest that if Great Britain had not helped to win two wars and taken the position that she did, and had not established the Balfour Declaration and the policy which arose from it, there would have been no Israel. This is a point of simple history which it is perfectly impossible to deny. I would like to deal also with this question of immigration. When Hitler came along, it was Britain's duty to see that the Arab and Muslim world was not pushed over onto the side of Hitler. If it had been, Hitler might have won the war. We hear a good deal of the wickedness of British imperialism. I suggest to you that if there had been no British Empire in the Near East in 1840 after the fall of France, no troops in Egypt, no means of defending the Suez Canal, that Rommel would have been victorious and German Nazi troops would have occupied Palestine. These things cannot be forgotten. Mr. St. John has made a reference to the repulse of the illegal immigrants. If a ship filled with Mexicans in defiance of your immigration law, which is much criticized, was approaching the harbor of New York, what would happen to that ship? But I go on to, by omission, I mean this, that while we have had this last year or two, books without number, articles without number, of the cruelties of Britain in respect of immigration into Palestine, I have never seen one book or one article anywhere pointing this fact out, which is based upon the figures of the United Nations, that since the beginning of the Hitlerite persecutions, Great Britain, this small country, since the war devastated with a fourth of its buildings destroyed, has admitted more displaced persons, not merely than any other country, but more displaced persons than all the other countries of the world put together.
Mr. St. John.
I just want to take this whole discussion back to a calmer level now. I would like to point out that in my book, which is not anti-British, incidentally, three of my grandparents were born in England, Sir Norman, and I worked in one of your munitions factories for a year during the war. I have a great deal of feeling for the ordinary people of Britain. I still don't like Mr. Bevan. I still don't like his policies. That does not make me anti-British. There are a lot of people that didn't like the policies of certain of our political figures at one time or another. Anyway, in the book, I have this quotation from an article by Gerson Agronsky, a very wonderful Palestinian journalist who is now in this country. He says, as a result, the British government in Palestine was once a fine and solidly wrought thing. Good men and true fashioned an honest administration, gave it a system of law, worked for its development, stimulated its cultivation, so forth and so forth. We shall live in hope that the good and the gracious and the just will triumph once more wherever Britons go. That is my hope. There is no use going back to Allenby and the Balfour Declaration to excuse the errors of commission and omission of Mr. Bevan, who has been called an anti-Semite by no less a person than the former Prime Minister, Mr. Churchill. It was what Britain did in the Middle East 30 years ago was fine, but Britain almost made it possible to kill every last Jew in the Middle East. And we can't go back and excuse them for that because they did something nice and good a long time ago, or because they admitted some Jews to England.
Norman.
I raise this point of the past because it is the point of the future. Unless we can make this reconciliation between Israel and the Arab and the Muslim world, you're going to see repeated in the future what you saw in 1914 and again in 1939, in which struggle Britain, like every belligerent, had to choose not between the entirely good course and the entirely bad, but had to make a choice of evils. It had to keep the Arab world and the Near East on its side. If it hadn't, the victory would have gone to Hitler, and that would have been the end of Israel. If we don't keep these lessons of the past in mind, we shall not so manage the future that we can avoid a third clash of the same kind. And unless we see the reasons for British conduct just before the war, in its white paper and so forth, and its accusations of appeasing the Arabs, if we don't see the reason for that, our policy of the future, not of the past, will be ill-guided.
And now, Miss Gruber, we've given you a very difficult situation to be placed between an angel and a saint. But with that difficulty,
I feel flattering.
Now...
I, I want to say this about Sir Norman's discussion of the past. One of the most astounding things to an American, it may not be astounding to anyone coming from England where there is so much voluntary self-censorship, but one of the most astounding things to me is the way a people can completely block out the past and change history. I remember an Egyptian colonel who was captured by the Israeli army who said to his captors, "But how did you capture me? Where are our forces in Beersheba that were to join us?" And the Israelis had to tell him that they had captured Beersheba 2 months before. I discovered the same thing in Britain, where the history books speak of the American Revolution as just a regrettable incident and go on to merrier things. And I think that the past of Britain's actions in Israel, in Palestine, since the middle of the war and the end of the war, when there was no longer any question of needing the Arabs to fight Germany, there was simply a question of saving Jewish lives. And Britain, instead of saving those lives, turned Palestine into a concentration camp. Instead of permitting Jews to escape from the Iron Curtain that Hitler had placed around Europe, Britain threw her own curtain around Palestine, the only country that was willing to accept them. I think for us to forget that past is equally evil. And I think one of the great things about Robert St. John's book is that he talks to people who haven't forgotten the past, who carry the purple numbers on the skin of their forearms, who will remember forever that when they escaped from Devon, they came home.
I'm struck by this discussion, which we've had here for almost a half an hour, about a book which is essentially a non-political book. Bob St. John has written a book which is essentially the report of his conversations and his observations upon people living in Israel, their own reactions to their own homeland. And actually, amount of political discussion in this book, I suppose, could be certainly contained within one chapter, certainly. What did you think of the reporting job on the conditions in Israel, which you get in this book, Sir Norman?
I thought it was a supremely good job.
And it is only then the political implications of the book.
It is the implications of it, the implications, and again the omissions.
Well, let's have Robert St. John supply some of those omissions then.
Well, John and Sir Norman and Ruth, I guess the only way to solve this is for me to go back someday to Israel, which I hope to do and which I would love to do, and write a 12-volume encyclopedia. And then I will come back, John, and face a panel of critics of yours and defend myself against all errors of omission.
I think you'll probably have to do that, Bob. I'm sorry that we haven't yet gotten into some of the other aspects of the book, some of the fascinating stories, the stories, for instance, of the two young Americans who joined the Israeli forces, one on the side of the Irgun and one on the side of the Israel government. And here, two men who had served in, one in the Canadian forces, rather, and one in the American forces, who found themselves firing on each other as the result of the differences of opinion between the Irgun and the Israeli government. I was fascinated, too, by the story of the brilliant German lawyer who left Germany in 1938 and then went to this fascinating Jewish cooperative farm in Israel, and I think you ought to talk a little bit about that farm because it was unique to me even in the cooperative movement, Bob.
Well, that farm, as you call it, John, is what is called in Hebrew a kibbutz. A kibbutz is a settlement. It's fascinating to fly over Israel and see the spots of green, these kibbutz. John, I don't think I can possibly boil down into one succinct sentence that long chapter. Let's suggest that maybe
the people read it.
That's it,
right? And they can get it in all its detail, and that's, of course, the most satisfying thing to do with any book. And I'm sorry, Miss Gruber and gentlemen, but time's up for both the author and his critics. And here is your announcer to tell you what lies ahead on The Author Meets the Critics.
Next week, The Author Meets the Critics will discuss one of the most enthusiastically acclaimed plays of the season, The Mad Woman of Chaillot. Our guest will be Maurice Valencia, adapted the play from the original French version, and one of the members of the cast. Be sure to be with us next week when Mr. Valencia and a member of the cast meet their critics face to face. And now, back to John McCaffrey.
Before we close, I'd like to thank Mr. St. John, Robert St. John, for coming here to discuss his new book, Shalom Means Peace. And to thank you, Miss Gruber and Sir Norman Angel, for joining us. This is John McCaffrey saying good afternoon for The Author Meets the Critics.
The Author Meets the Critics is produced by Martin Jones and directed by Lee Jones. This is Arthur Gary speaking. Laugh with Fred Allen tonight on NBC.